We now have access to a range of detailed microdata sources on low-income countries that we didn't have even 10 or 15 years ago. And so that's opened up lots of new frontiers for research.
Welcome to another Vox Dev Talk, recorded live at the Center for Economic Policy Research Paris Symposium 2023. My name is Tim Phillips. How can macroeconomics and macroeconomists contribute to what we know about development policy? Well, that was the topic of one of the panels at the symposium. Doug Gollin of Tufts, he's also Research Director of Structural Transformation and Economic Growth. That's a five-year research initiative that seeks to answer some of these questions. And Paolo Bustos of Pompeo Fabra were on the panel, and they both join me now. Doug, hello.
Hi, Tim.
And Paolo, welcome.
Hello.
Development hasn't historically been a priority topic for macroeconomists, has it? Now, has this changed now? And if it's changed, why is it changing?
So I think there are a couple of reasons for that, Tim. I think historically, macroeconomists, and really macroeconomics as a field, has tended to focus on the problems of advanced economies, of high-income countries, and then has also tended to focus on issues of stabilization, monetary and fiscal policy. And for low-income countries, issues of economic growth have always seemed challenging for macroeconomics.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's changed is that as we've come to find new data sources and to understand the types of problems that really seem to bind in low-income countries, it's really sparked a range of research in macroeconomics as people have brought some of the tools of general equilibrium modeling and some of the new insights that have come from the macroeconomics literature and have brought that to bear on the challenges of low-income countries. So I think it really is a change, and I think it's an exciting time in the macro growth development literature.
I mean, specifically, what innovations are helping to shape this macro literature?
I think there are three categories of things that have changed, and I'd like to credit our colleague Rachel Nye from Imperial College and LSE, who really talks about three things, one of which is a change in the tools, a second of which is a change in the data, and a third of which I think is really important, is a change in the mix of people doing the research.
Oh.
The tools are the same kind of advances that we've seen across the economics discipline, increasing in computational power, the ability to work with more complex models, models with much more heterogeneity, models of heterogeneous firms and people, and so as a set of tools that allow us to ask much more interesting questions. The data has been really transformational. We now have access to a range of detailed microdata sources on low-income countries that we didn't have even 10 or 15 years ago. It used to be that macroeconomics worked only with national income data, aggregate statistics, and all of a sudden we have access to household survey data, to detailed firm data, in some cases to administrative records like value-added taxation data, satellite imagery, a whole range of data sources that we didn't have before. And so that's opened up lots of new frontiers for research. What I think is unfinished business in many ways is that we've expanded the pool of people working in this area. And I think increasingly we're seeing economists from different countries and different backgrounds with familiarity with different contexts who have expanded the set of people working in this area and brought new insights. And I think that's really unfinished business. We're still not nearly diverse enough as a field, but I think it's got a lot to offer.
Recently on Vox Dev Talks, we spoke to Joe Kobosky and Paco Buera. I know you've worked with Joe very closely over the years at STEG about bridging the gap between macro research and micro research. What's your opinion on how that's evolving?
Some progress has been made. Macroeconomists are looking at microdata in detail. I think the trade literature was a pioneer on that in the sense of getting models with general equilibrium forces and trying to map those to microeconomic mechanisms that could be tracked into detailed data. And I think macroeconomists are increasingly looking for evidence on these important mechanisms on microdata. So in that sense, I think that is an exciting development that is going to make models much more relevant.
I think there was a sense even a few years ago that the micro development research and the macro development research were answering different questions, that they didn't mix very well. And I think it's been really exciting to see the literatures converging in some important ways. Macro people, as Paula says, working with micro data and taking seriously micro structures, but also micro people starting to use models and frameworks that were more common before in the macro literature. I think it's really come a long way. I do see it as a positive thing. It's also probably true that the literatures have some different emphases, and our colleague Eliana LaFerrara made the point that she didn't think that necessarily we'd see these two literatures merging into one. Instead, there are some important strands that will remain separate. And I think that's realistic and a positive thing.
Yeah, I think she made a very good point, which is that it's impossible to zoom in all the details when you want to look at the big picture, right? So I think there is a complementarity between the two literatures in the sense that some people looking carefully at certain mechanisms using microdata can inform people looking at macro models where many different mechanisms take place at the same time, and it's impossible to zoom in each of them with the same level of detail.
Every time that I'm talking to microeconomists about development, they warn not to assume that what they've discovered is going to be the same in other places, in other contexts, at other times. This must be a challenge to any kind of macro modeling.
On this point, Rachel and Guy made a very good comment on the panel that we just had. And she mentioned how something that she likes about economics is how we focus on general mechanisms. And then we can have a model where all these main mechanisms are in place. However, in different countries, which have different institutional constraints, different culture or different costs, some of these mechanisms will be more important than others. One example is female labor force participation. If we think about what's the effect of some home production taking place in the market, we cannot explain that that is going to have the same effect on female labor force participation in a developed country than in a developing country where markets are less developed, or in countries where there are cultural norms against women participating in the labor force. But those can be part of the model as different costs or parameters, but all these mechanisms can be part of the same model.
So I want to talk a little bit about trade as it relates to development. Is there now much more of a focus on within-country trade rather than just talking about trade across borders?
I would say so, yes. I think this is the case in the literature. This is partly due to the big success of the empirical trade literature in the last 20 years, in the sense that I think there is now a consensus that reductions in trade costs and the possibility to participate in export markets has very large effects on firm productivity. So there was a lot of effort trying to link different theoretical mechanisms, linking trade to growth and development, to very detailed micro data on firms, innovation, FDI. And I think at this point, the evidence in favor of these both export market participation and imports of intermediate goods being very important for productivity growth is very convincing. What I think was less convincing at some point was what was the effect of this firm-level productivity growth on welfare and whether this had economy-wide positive effects on workers. And here the literature started to implement, you know, empirical strategies that exploited variation across local labor markets within countries in this exposure to trade shocks, and found, in the first case was in India by Petia Topalova, that she found that there were negative effects on the income of rural workers in India of the trade liberalization that India undertook in the 90s. And some papers like author Doran Hanson followed up to show negative effects of the China shock, industrial workers' employment prospects and income in the US. And then there's also some work in Brazil. I think these findings, people, because they were using a local labor market approach, were showing that despite losses in income, workers were not out-migrating to other labor markets less negatively affected by trade. And this was very surprising because there's no formal migration frictions within countries. Mm-hmm. So I think this started some interest within trade economies on what happens with these spatial frictions within countries and why these markets appear to be separate. So that was one of the reasons. A second reason is work of trade and development economies like Dave Donaldson that showed that in India and in some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, there were substantial trade costs within country across locations and how improvements in transportation infrastructure were reducing those costs. So I think this made people aware that these trade costs were important and that these were probably part of the reason why international trade liberalization was not having the positive effects on worker welfare that we would be expecting from models that didn't take into account these frictions.
We always used to talk about international trade as a driver of structural transformation. I think I've had a conversation with you about it in the past. Is it still relevant?
International trade is certainly still relevant. And people remind me periodically that the only examples we have of countries that have undergone rapid growth and transformation in the past decades seem to have done this with a heavy reliance on trade and exports. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we fully understand what that relationship is, and I'm not sure we fully understand whether that's a necessary or an essential part of a transformation and growth process. But there's no question that this has historically been an important mechanism for lots of countries. Whether that's still true in an evolving world with changes in AI and robotics and other major changes that are unfolding in the world economy, I think is an open question.
I definitely agree with that view. There's this recent paper by Goldberg and Reed showing that all recent episodes of sustained poverty reduction were preceded by fast export growth. Mm-hmm. So I think it's clear that in the past, this has been important. This process has been good mostly for East Asian countries. And it is true that countries in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa have not experienced this structural transformation process at the same level of speed. One of the concerns that has been raised is that these countries have a comparative advantage in agriculture or natural resources that retards this structural transformation process because they specialize in these comparative advantage sectors and because the income gains in these sectors tend to be concentrated in landowners and owners of these natural resources.
Doug, these sort of questions were the sorts of things that Steg was set up to investigate. A few years back, you were calling for new research and to move on the process of macro development economics. Has it succeeded well so far?
I think it has. I think Steg has had a really important impact on the development of this literature. A couple of things stand out. One is that simply we've funded probably almost 200 research projects to this point. And so the literature in this area has expanded. And as we've expanded and brought new people into the community of scholars working in this area and had a new set of questions tackled, I think we've expanded the scope of research in this area quite a bit. I think having more resources makes a difference. I also think that Steg has played a really important role in validating and legitimizing this kind of research for graduate students or scholars looking to do macro work who might not have thought about doing it in a developing country. I think Steg has helped point people in that direction. The network effect of bringing people together for conferences, promoting a conversation within the research community, I think has been important. But I was really struck when we were talking earlier, Paula interpreted this in part as a spatial friction.
Yeah, what I was saying is that researchers are mostly located in rich countries, and then there's easy data access for detailed data on these rich countries.
Yeah.
However, it's very costly to access data from developing countries. One of the reasons is you need to travel there and then you need to collect this data. It's not readily available, or you are going to be the first person to use some data source, and that is much more costly. So you can think of this as a spatial friction, no? Between whether researchers and data are located and where research needs are larger. And I think Steg has been good at helping to solve this friction in the sense that it has been giving a lot of grants to young researchers to go travel and access these different data sources. So I think that's a very productive part of the program.
Okay, so finally, I want you to give some advice to those young researchers. The areas that you see that are going to be interesting and creative for research in this topic in the near future?
Areas that I think are important is to think about which type of frictions are important and which policies can address them. I mean, if there are labor market frictions, what type of labor market policies can we do apart from investment in infrastructure to think about how to solve these frictions? And same with goods market integration. Which type of policy is going to address goods markets frictions? And then one big topic is, given those frictions, how developing countries are going to adjust to climate change. A lot of this adjustment is expected to take place by reallocating people across space and across sectors. But if we are saying that developing countries are characterized by these reallocation frictions, then we should be doing a lot of research in understanding how to help this reallocation process.
Within the environmental area, issues around biodiversity loss, around water availability, around deforestation. So many issues there that haven't really been looked at through a macroeconomic lens.
No.
I think there's also a whole host of questions around inclusion, broadly defined, around the inclusion of women in the economy. And as we've talked about in the past, Tim, interesting questions around the movement of economic activity from home to market and market to home. How that's changing as economies develop, as market service sector emerges. Questions around urbanization and urbanization processes very broadly defined as the cities in the developing world grow very large and as the challenges of managing urbanization become important. I think there's a lot of scope for research in this area and for research to influence policy.
The work's only just beginning. Thank you very much for talking to me about it today. Thank you, Paola.
Thank you, Tim.
Doug.
Thank you, Tim.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.